Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war is being fought right now, as we speak, in the highest levels of the United States government. It is a high drama as the President of the United States weighs the future of his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, a man who has been insubordinate in the extreme, who has, I believe, undermined the president at every turn, and who is now purging the ranks of the National Security Council of individuals who are loyal to the president in favor of Obama holdovers and others who do not share the president's agenda. To discuss this and much more, I'm very pleased to say we have with us Daniel Horowitz, one of the great young minds at work on the public policy stage these days. He is the senior editor of Conservative Review, a tremendous online resource with which Mark Levin is associated. He has a distinguished record with the Madison Project as a contributor to The Blaze and Breitbart and through other vehicles, notably through his best-selling book, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. One might add, how to stop an unelected national security advisor from transforming America as well. Daniel Horowitz, so good to have you. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Great to be with you and discuss the four branches of government.
There we go. Let's start with branch one, I guess, the executive branch. What do you make of what H.R. McMaster, Lieutenant General of the United States Army, has been doing in his role as national security advisor to Donald Trump?
This is a problem when you have a non-ideological president who's really very green on a lot of the issues. Trump said a lot of really good things in the campaign, still does, and delivers them on social media. But the problem was that at the beginning of his presidency, and in the case of McMaster, he hired individuals that absolutely didn't share his worldview. In the case of McMaster, he's antithetical to Trump's worldview expressed on the campaign trail. Basically, from his time at CENTCOM, McMaster has developed the full Arabist worldview, that Israel is an enemy. He's as anti-Israel as anyone in the Obama administration. He's pro-Iran deal. He wants to get all of our troops involved in every Islamic civil war to the detriment of our country. Literally, if you would check the boxes on 10 of Trump's campaign promises, he's on the opposite side of every one of them. And now he's purging all of Trump's own loyalists from the National Security Council. And it's not even like he's keeping so many establishment Republicans. They're Democrats there.
It's not as though there are that many on the staff to begin with. You know, there were some that were brought in by Mike Flynn before he was fired, but they're now being systematically removed from the NSC. Carolyn Glick, colleague of ours at the Center for Security Policy and an old friend of yours, has written a powerful post on her Facebook page about all this. You know, I'm reminded of back in my day, Daniel Horowitz, then Secretary of State Al Haig was fired by Ronald Reagan for a lot less insubordination and working at cross purposes than McMaster has done, well, basically from day one. Do you think that there is really any hope for this Trump presidency if he does not respond to what I think of as a coup d'etat by McMaster that is going forward as we're talking?
I definitely say that his foreign policy is done if he cannot get rid of him. If I had one button to press to eject a member of this administration, I would pick McMaster. Now, I know you share my view and concerns about Tillerson as Secretary of State. We know the State Department is a complete dumpster fire. It is full of Obama holdovers. But at least if you have control of the NSC, that is the arm of the White House, you could rein in the State Department. You could overrule them. And I think we'll see in the coming 48 to 72 hours, certainly conservatives have gotten this complaint to the president. I'm proud to see that conservatives have been on message. So I think that's there. And a lot of it will depend on the new chief of staff. I mean, this at its core is former Secretary Kelly's new job.
Hey, listen, let me turn to another topic that I know is near and dear to your heart. You've done really great work on the immigration issue, and I wondered what you made of the president's endorsement yesterday of the bill that has been advanced in the United States Senate by Senators Cotton and Perdue, dealing specifically with the issue of legal immigration.
As my boss, Mark Levin, said on his radio show last night, this was Trump's finest moment. This has filled the vacuum that a lot of us sensed in many other issues, most prominently health care, where you just didn't see the presidential leadership from the get-go saying that this is the White House position. Yes, mechanically, Congress or a member of Congress introduces legislation, but really the president, when his party controls Congress, he takes the lead on the big issues. That's exactly what he did on immigration. This bill, the RAISE Act, addresses the most important component of our immigration problem. The problem right now is the sovereignty has been stolen from the citizenry. Rather than the citizenry choosing through a set of broad, universal, common sense criterion who we want to allow into the country, we have what's called chain migration, where the keys to our immigration, the keys to our future orientation of our civil society, voting members of our society, who will determine the character of the nature of the nation, is placed in the hands of the immigrants themselves. It's all family-based. So after Ted Kennedy broke our immigration system in 1965, and the 70s, 80s, we started to have predominantly low-skilled immigrants from the third world countries, a real divorce from past precedent. What happened was we got more of the same. What this bill does is it puts pen to paper on the broad platitudes and principles that everyone says they support, including Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, and even Chuck Schumer. Merit-based, everyone's got to learn English. Well, this is exactly what the proposal does.
And, you know, to your subtitle of Stolen Sovereignty, how to stop unelected judges from transforming America, Daniel Horowitz, you, of course, have also pointed out that people on the bench are trying to ascribe to overseas individuals, foreign nationals with no connection to the United States, some sort of right to come here. So all of these things are tied together and are, as you say, a mortal threat to our sovereignty. Lastly, and very quickly, Daniel, I did want to ask you, Republicans have finally gotten their footing on the question of establishing where there really is evidence of collusion with Russia by calling for special counsel to look into what Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton have done in that regard over the years. We're now being told by their apologists that, well, this is a sort of idea of prosecuting a political foe who's been defeated, a kind of banana republic thing beneath American mores. How would you respond to the need to get to the bottom of what has, I believe, well-documented evidence behind it in terms of such collusion on the part of the Clintons?
In January, honestly, I actually harbored that view. I actually felt that, look, we won the election. Let our views, our immigration, healthcare, foreign policy proposals stand above all the media clamor over some of the scandals and move on. But that argument has been completely countermanded by the fact that the incumbent administration is now being investigated. So if the sitting administration could be investigated, certainly, you know, the past one out of power, there's no banana republic problem with that to begin with. And like you said, the difference is there is no evidence. There's just innuendo with Trump, whereas with Hillary, James Comey himself issued an indictment, I mean, in rhetoric, and then didn't issue launch a formal investigation and lead to an indictment. That is a very serious problem. What we know she did, what we know about the unprecedented lengths that Comey went to grant immunity to people that were actually a subject of the investigation. Again, I think the fact that we have Mueller investigating the Trump administration, that's the perfect opportunity.
Yeah. And to the point that this is about specific acts of collusion. This isn't just about email scandals and mishandling of classified information and so on. This is direct involvement with the Russians to benefit the Clinton Foundation, their own personal wealth at the expense of the national security. This is something that it seems to me we have to get to the bottom of as part of a proper investigation of such matters. we have to leave it at that for the moment. I had wanted to talk to you about Senator Jeff Flake's recent book, but that's for another day. Daniel Horowitz, I am so appreciative to you for taking the time to join us, and also for your great work at Conservative Review. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll explore some of these issues with our colleague Fred Flights, specifically on what to make of the McMaster purge and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Fred Flights, my colleague and friend at the Center for Security Policy, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs, a 20-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency, the right-hand man of John Bolton as his Chief of Staff when he was Undersecretary of State, and a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee. Always a welcome guest here. Fred, good to have you back.
Hey, Frank, good to be here.
I'd like to pick up with something that I was talking about a moment ago with our previous guest, Daniel Horowitz, namely this idea that if one's interested in really getting to the bottom of collusion between the Russians and U.S. officials, that the lens has to be broadened beyond just the Trump campaign or Trump transition, which has been the exclusive focus of it to date. There are some, like National Public Radio, that have been taking the view that this would be out of bounds somehow to do this in connection with specifically Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's, because they are former officials who were defeated political adversaries and therefore somehow should get a pass. Fred, you've worked on the Hill. You've been a member, as I say, of the staff of the Intelligence Committee, one of those that is looking into these matters. In your judgment, should the United States government be evaluating what kind of collusive behavior the Clintons engaged in, especially as it seems to have not only benefited them financially, but harmed the national security?
I don't know, Frank. Isn't it funny that investigations of the Clintons always seem to be out of bounds? Look at all the things that happened during Bill Clinton's investigation. Records disappearing, the secret health care panel. I mean, if a Republican had done any of these things, they would not just have been impeached. They would have been convicted and removed from office. And I think the record of what Hillary Clinton did in terms of pay for play with the Russians, selling one-fifth of America's uranium reserve to a Russian-controlled company, speeches given by Bill Clinton where he received huge payments while she was Secretary of State, these things obviously represent inappropriate activities. But I think these were efforts by foreign entities to buy influence from a potential president. Concerning the argument that, well, we shouldn't look into this because she's a failed presidential candidate, I have some sympathy for that argument, but not right now, not when the Democrats refuse to accept the legitimacy of the election of this president. They've changed the rules, and I think we have to change the rules, too.
That's something that Daniel Horowitz alluded to as well. I don't actually think this has anything to do with politics. This has to do with the ground truth, which is what we're expecting Bob Mueller and the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and others investigating these matters to get at. And if it is the case that we're concerned about the possibility that American security or American interests have been compromised by specifically Russian influence operations, the American people are entitled to know when did that happen and by whom. And that should be, it seems to me, above partisanship. It should be to let the chips fall where they may, and it should involve as comprehensive a review of these matters. And I would include in the matter, in that investigation, by the way, the President of the United States himself, Barack Obama, who we have videotape saying he wanted Vladimir Putin's help in the election of 2012. In exchange for which he would give him concessions on missile defense thereafter. I mean, these are things that I think we have, an obligation to establish the facts about, and where the chips fall, they must fall. Fred, let me turn to another topic on which I did want to ask you, having spent most of your professional life in one incarnation or another, worrying about, warning of, and trying to counter the great and growing danger from North Korea. Your former boss, John Bolton, has written in the Wall Street Journal today about the need for regime change in North Korea is really the only thing that is going to prevent this threat from metastasizing ominously and perhaps resulting in the death of Americans. Tell me about your views on that policy recommendation by John Bolton.
Well, Mr. Bolton's position is that the trajectory of North Korea's nuclear missile programs is extremely worrisome. They're not going to continue to build up these programs indefinitely without some type of military conflict breaking out, either through an accident or miscalculation, or maybe someday North Korea it will use its nuclear arsenal to basically issue an ultimatum, reunite the Korean Peninsula under us. And I think that Mr. Bolton's recognizing that this is a very serious situation. This president cannot kick down the road. He discusses various military options that could be used against North Korea, and I know he's not happy about this. But I know that he's very worried, given the fact that the North Koreans now appear to have ballistic missiles that can easily hit the United States. I question whether they have the guidance system to hit them precisely. But frankly, the U.S. is so large, I suspect the North Koreans could simply aim a missile in that direction. They do have to get a reentry vehicle, so a warhead could actually detonate over target territory. But we should not underestimate their nuclear missile programs. They have developed them far faster than experts had predicted.
Well, and there's also, as you know, Fred Flights, the informed judgment, shall we say, of former Director of Central Intelligence Jim Woolsey and the former Executive Director of the EMP Threat Commission of the Congress, Peter Pry, that the North Koreans may simply be putting nuclear weapons aboard satellites, which a single one could conceivably unleash a devastating EMP, electromagnetic pulse attack against this country without having to worry about hitting some specific target or re-entering the atmosphere. Just do it from space. So in all these regards, I think we're on borrowed time, and I fear that the recommendation that John Bolton is making is absolutely needed. We'll, again, be talking about that more with Claudia in a moment. Fred, let me ask you about one other thing you've been reporting on at Newsmax, the demasking scandal of the Obama administration. You say it's not simply growing, it's surging. Talk a bit about that. What is the demasking scandal, first off, and what does it mean that it is surging?
Well, just quickly, when a name of an American citizen is collected in an intelligence report, we mask it because U.S. intelligence agencies are not allowed to collect against U.S. citizens without a court order. I mean, this is because they are foreign intelligence collection entities. They're not supposed to collect domestically. It's possible for a U.S. official to ask for the name of such an American, but it's done rarely, and it's a very serious matter. We now know from the House Intelligence Committee that in the final year of the Obama administration, hundreds of requests were made, and apparently most of them were of Trump campaign and transition officials. And over 100 of these were made by former U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power. Now, I've supported many U.N. ambassadors, and I can't conceive of a reason that Samantha Power would need the demasked names of Trump campaign and transition officials. I can't think of a national security reason. Clearly, the Obama administration was weaponizing intelligence to target Mr. Trump. And also, there's a letter from the House Intelligence Committee chairman that they couldn't find a justification for these demasking requests, but they did find that after many of them were made, information from these requests were leaked to the news media.
Oh, no kidding. Is that right? Sink me. This is shocking in the extreme, unless you know the Obama team. And Samantha Power, as one of the political operatives, another apparently implicated in this growing scandal, is Ben Rhodes, former deputy national security advisor, and the hatchet man on what you called the Obama bomb deal in your book, which describes it as a dangerous growing national security fraud. Fred Flights, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today, as well as the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. We will indeed next talk to Claudia Rosette, ACE investigative reporter, on these issues and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, joined by the great Claudia Rosette, one of the truly stupendous investigative reporters of our time, or, well, from my lights, any time. But particularly in the past few decades, the reporting that she has done, the analysis, the investigations she's conducted, notably for The Wall Street Journal, have been not only prize-winning, but breathtaking in their importance and impact. These days, you can find her at PJ Media's Rosette Report. She is a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, and she also writes a foreign affairs column for Forbes.com. We're always thrilled to have her with us. Claudia Rosette, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
One of your special passions, I know, for many years has been North Korea. And I was very pleased to see in today's Wall Street Journal that John Bolton said what needs to be said, it seems to me, about the necessity of effecting regime change there in North Korea. Talk a little bit about both that insight and the fact that it seems to be exactly the opposite of what Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, has said as recently as earlier this week.
I mean, we're getting quite a set of mixed messages from the administration on this, but we've been getting crazy messages for decades at this point from a whole series of administrations. Ambassador Bolton, and I wish he were still in an administration, said in the Wall Street Journal, is we really need to be talking about military options, that's probably the only thing that's really going to stop what has become a rapidly progressing nuclear program. I mean, North Korea now has a nuclear arsenal, has tested two ICBMs last month. We're no longer talking about somewhere out there in the future. And Frank, the United States has been discussing this and bargaining over it for so many years. None of this has actually stopped North Korea's nuclear program. One of the big problems being that North Korea is not run by a government that's concerned about how well its people are doing. It's run by a totalitarian regime that didn't mind starving an estimated 1 million North Koreans to death in the mid-90s as they sort of diverted food only to those deemed the most loyal. And now that there has been a hereditary succession while on President Obama's watch, Kim Jong-un has been in power for more than 5 years. He's managed to do away with various potential rivals. He's executed his uncle. His half-brother was assassinated with VX nerve agent in a Malaysian airport. And this is the regime that is testing nuclear weapons.
Claudia, that point is so well taken, that a government that treats its own people so horribly is unlikely to deal with ours, or for that matter, others we care about, with anything more gentle, shall we say. I'm wondering, you've written at PJ Media about North Korea's ICBMs and our words. Yet I think you were pleased shortly thereafter that Nikki Haley at the United Nations, our ambassador there, responded rather better than just doing more words. Talk about what is going on inside the Trump administration, as best one can tell, vis-a-vis North Korea, and somewhat at odds with the seeming thrust of Rex Tillerson's views.
Sure. As best one can tell, we have President Trump saying, we'll handle it. You know, don't worry. Well, that's very generic. Then we had, after North Korea's second ICBM test in a month, there was this great outpouring of words. There's a formula reaction that the U.S. and various other prominent voices have to every North Korean milestone in its nuclear missile program. They condemn, they deplore, and then usually there's an emergency meeting of the Security Council at which Russia and China stick up for North Korea, everybody discusses, and then maybe there's a statement or another sanctions resolution, and then we do it all again, except North Korea has advanced further. Well, that was exactly the formula that was being followed on Saturday. President Trump said the U.S. condemns the launch. Secretary of State Tillerson said the U.S. strongly condemns the launch. And I wrote something saying, you know, this is just words, words, words. Well, on Sunday, Ambassador Haley put out a statement saying, actually, contrary to the report, some reports, that the U.S. is not seeking an emergency meeting of the U.N. Security Council. And I thought, aha, finally, a break in this pattern. That's different, because one of the problems with this pattern of words is that North Korea almost certainly regards it as reassuring. It's the usual formula. They do something, we react with all sorts of statements that have been rendered meaningless because we don't do anything that really hurts them. And this is a small change, but at least what Ambassador Haley said was not only that she wouldn't be seeking an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, but that to hold a meeting that didn't really produce anything of worth would be worse than ineffective, because it would simply tell the North Koreans, we're not serious. She said the time for talk is over. And I thought, hallelujah, because we have talked for more than 20 years.
As this problem has metastasized. Now, Claudia, let me, in the closing couple of minutes we have with you, ask you about one of the reasons why that's so. And again, you've spent a lot of time in that part of the world covering China for the Wall Street Journal, among others. And I'm wondering what you're making of the Chinese conduct at the moment. They certainly don't seem to be backing away from North Korea. In fact, the president's made no secret of the fact he's very frustrated that his new pal, Xi Jinping, turns out not to be cooperating with the United States and bringing the North Koreans to heel. But more to the point, Claudia, as you know, on the occasion of an anniversary of the founding of the People's Liberation Army, President Xi unburdened himself of a very, very nationalistic, aggressive, and in fact, quite threatening speech. And I wonder, are we now looking at the inevitable result of all of this palaver, which is not only an increasing danger from North Korea, but a China that is increasingly confident that it can support the North Koreans, it can exploit their bad behavior to the benefit of China and threaten us with impunity?
Yes. In fact, we're looking at the problem also of not just with China, but behind them is also Russia, with which they have been conducting joint military maneuvers for years now. And that is not something that developed on President Trump's watch. That really began to become a serious problem on President Obama's watch when nothing was done. And it was only in the final year of his administration, or actually only after the election, that suddenly a great alarm went off over Russia. Until then, he was rather dismissing it. But yeah, Frank, the problem here is, and by the way, let's just add that after Nikki Haley said all these things where I thought, yes, the pattern's being broken, then Secretary of State Tillerson came out with a statement on Monday saying, we're not seeking to overthrow the North Korean regime, or we're not their enemy. You know, we want to find some solution that, well, they'll feel okay. Which I thought, they are our enemy, actually. They're threatening us with ICBMs. That's not good. But the problem that we have at this point, and it's not a pleasant one to face, but we really have to, is that there is this rising network. You know, we could call it an axis, a network, a set of connected countries that with interests hostile to the United States. And they, 20 years ago, the U.S. was really sort of the lone superpower. We're still a force that could obliterate any given enemy. But there is this latticework rising, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea with its weapons, you know, which otherwise is a country that's really nothing. It's an inconsequential, beggared tyranny. But it's now got these terrible weapons, and it holds Seoul hostage with its artillery. It's got this huge and increasingly dangerously armed military. You've got this whole nexus. And I've been skeptical for years that China will ever really help with this. I think the official line from China is that it doesn't want North Korea going nuclear. It wants stability and so on. It wants a status quo. If you look at their actions, that is not what they've been willing to tolerate.
Including arming the North Koreans, as best we can tell. Claudia, we are out of time. There's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll join us again very soon. But thank you for this call, for regime change in North Korea. I think we can accept no substitutes. There are dangers associated with it, to be sure, but the dangers that are coming in its absence make those pale by comparison, I'm afraid. I appreciate the work you do at PJ Media and also at Forbes and, of course, with the Independent Women's Forum, but most especially our visits with you. Come back soon. Next up, we'll talk with Elizabeth Yor about female genital mutilation and why it must be ended today. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Liz Yor, a woman I've come to know and admire greatly for her record of service both to the state of Illinois and to the country as a whole in connection with trying to protect children and others from the crimes that are perpetrated against them, trafficking, abuse, and in particular of late, female genital mutilation. She served as the general counsel of the state of Illinois' Department of Children and Family Services. She was also the general counsel for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and a special counsel to Oprah Winfrey in connection with her child advocacy efforts. I'm very pleased to say she is these days working with an important initiative called End FGM Today. And I'm very excited about the chance to talk with her about the efforts of that group, particularly against the backdrop of a reverse that the cause of prohibiting FGM suffered in the state of Maine yesterday. We'll talk with her about that. But first, welcome, Liz. You're so good to have you.
Delighted to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
Could you take just a minute and sort of set the stage for this conversation by explaining to us what female genital mutilation is and where it is practiced?
Female genital mutilation is a religious and cultural practice that has existed for centuries, if not millennia. It's practiced primarily in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. In its hideous and brutal practice, imposed little girls, and it is, among many things, the excision of their clitoris. It happens and is performed by just plain old people. They bring in their children to these mutilators to cut the genitals of the little girls, sometimes to sew the genitals of the little girls. The whole purpose of it is to suppress the female sexual expression and pleasure. It is to impose submission to females so that they do not have the ability to enjoy sexual expression. And as a result, it is being imported into our shores in the United States. The World Health Organization has declared this a human rights violation. And as well as the UN has been repeatedly urging countries around the world to criminalize FGM. And we in the United States, until now, have not really been faced with this hideous practice. And until now, when we see it with the massive influx of Muslim migrants from the Middle East, we're now faced with having to address this practice. It's hard to believe that it's here on our shores. Interestingly, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, estimates that 513,000 little girls in the United States are subject to this or at risk of FGM. We only have to look, Frank, to Germany. In 1 year, the incidence of FGM tripled. If it goes unchecked, this is what we are facing in the United States.
Yeah, 513,000 of these mutilations is an epidemic, I think, by any definition. This is something that, of course, has come to light in particular, Liz Yor, as you know, in the state of Michigan as a result of a federal prosecution underway there. Talk a little bit about that, and then I want to turn to what's going on in Maine at the moment.
Sure. In April, there was a federal indictment of a doctor who had performed this hideous practice, female doctor. She was a member of the Dawoodi Bohra cult. It's a Shiite Muslim cult. It is in the United States. In fact, they have 22 mosques in the United States. She had performed FGM on two little girls who were brought from Minnesota to Michigan by their mothers. The investigation has grown exponentially, Frank. The FBI, in their wisdom, started a hotline for victims of FGM or for information regarding this hideous practice. And as a result, they have indicated that there's over 100 victims of FGM related to this case, that the case has grown, and I argue, much like human trafficking. This is the underground network. The case has expanded from Michigan to Chicago, to LA, and to New York. I think it will continue to grow. And this is, you know, quite frankly, the importance of prosecutions is because it allows this criminal, secret, covert practice to come out in the light.
This brings us to Maine, where just yesterday, the state Senate failed to take steps that would have permitted the bill to come to a vote in the Senate as well as in the House. And Lizier, tell me, why would anybody in the state of Maine or otherwise not want to prohibit this violence against little girls when there's such evidence that it is happening not just in some foreign land, but here in our own country?
The federal government identified Maine as one of the top tier 8 at risk of FGM because of the high per capita population of Somali refugees in Maine. UNICEF identified 97% of Somali women are subjected to FGM. And so we are importing this practice into the United States. That's why Maine was so key. And the Prosecutors Association said that they needed this bill. They testified on behalf of this bill that the laws on the books did not address, the criminal laws did not address this practice. And yet, even though the prosecutors and many of the Republican legislators who had struggled very hard to craft a bill to address this practice in Maine,
it's appalling. So Liz, where are the feminists? Where are the people who are much in evidence in connection with other instances of child abuse or bullying or human trafficking? I mean, how is it that people are not up in arms about this, not just in Maine, but elsewhere as well?
Well, Frank, we did smoke out the opposition in our FGM and FGM Today project to try and get this bill passed. And the liberal progressive feminists provided us with their pathetic rationale and lame excuses. It's really a shocking reality that liberal democratic women in Maine, in the legislature, opposed this bill. I mean, I asked the question, what happened to violence against women? Isn't this an issue that the liberal women fight so mightily against? What happened to women empowerment? What did the women's pink knit cap symbolize, if not dignity and protection of women? Well, we saw that in Maine, that this is what we learned. There is a priority of interest in the liberal progressive hierarchy. And the moving force behind this opposition to FGM was the ACLU. And so we know that. That's right. And, you know, the ultimate goddess, if you will, for liberal Democrats and ACLU is worshiping at the altar of political correctness, cultural diversity and tolerance. And these female liberal Democratic legislators made a political calculation that these Somali women are their constituents and voters, and they don't want to alienate them, no matter how heinous or brutal this cultural and religious practice.
It may be less the Somali women, actually, Liz. It may be the Somali men that are going along with this program as well, of course. Liz, we have to leave it at that. We are hard out of time. I'm so appreciative of the work you're doing at End FGM Today, and I look forward to talking with you in the near future about it. This reverse in Maine, I think, is temporary, but I'm hoping that it will arouse the country to action against this brutal and horrifically anti-woman practice. Keep up the good work. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.